Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Wednesday night edition of Sports Conversation on Fighting Network. I'm Don Henderson. My pleasure to host the show again this evening. We've got a great group of guests and also a great group of broadcasters around the country to talk to us on the show. Our executive producer is Frank Carroll. As always, he's got a dedication before we get down to Tampa and before we get Roy Cummings on the line first. Frank?
Yeah, Don. Yesterday marked the 13th anniversary of the loss of our founding father, Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll. We were awakened at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock in the morning on the 18th of June, 13 years ago, only to hear from Sergeant Mike O'Brien that my son had passed away from a gunshot wound. Bob had touched many lives around the world. As a young athlete, he was a very prominent athlete, did very good, very well in running and track and field. He touched the lives of many, many people in a very, very positive way. So tonight's program is dedicated in memory of Bob. We know he's listening. He always does. He keeps me going. And it's great to have a partner listening to me where it counts.
Thank you very much, Frank. And I'll tell you, he was one of the ones that initiated the program years ago and a terrific, terrific officer and a terrific guy. So let's get right into tonight's show. As I said a moment ago, Roy Cummings is at the helm. And Roy, we're going to jump quickly through a number of topics before we get into something long length. Willie Mays is right at the top of the list, 93 years old yesterday when he passed away. Your observations first before I put in a comment.
Well, boy, it's, you know, just probably more what you've been hearing over the last 24 hours since we heard of his passing, which is, of course, unfortunate. But 93 years old, that's one heck of a life that he lived, and what a legacy. Obviously, one of the greatest players of all time. And you know what? I think you can make the argument the most, to use a phrase, a current phrase, the most toolsy player of all time, perhaps. I'm not sure anyone had the blend of tools that he had in terms of foot speed, arm strength, hitting for power, hitting for average, defensive ability. He could absolutely do it all. You know, I mean, we think we're seeing something special in Shohei Ohtani, and we are. And prior to that, you certainly saw something special in Babe Ruth. But Willie Mays did things that those guys can't. And he played the outfield better than they did, even though Ruth was exceptional. You know, he didn't pitch, but he did everything else. And arguably the greatest player of all time. I think you could – you could certainly make that argument. I think you'd have to, you know, possibly Ted Williams. But did anyone do it for as long and consistently as Willie Mays? It's really hard to know. And I don't think anyone did. I mean, certainly players have had certain stretches and runs where they were outstanding, but Willie Mays did it as well as anyone for as long as anyone. And I think you can make the argument greatest player of all time.
I think he's the greatest ball player I ever saw, and I got to go right along with you, Roy. I never saw a player that had the ability that he did. I saw him the first time. I was just about 7 years old. The Giant Farm System had a team in Trenton, New Jersey, where I grew up, Dunfield in Trenton, New Jersey. He came up in 1950 and played for the Trenton Giants at that particular time before he went in 51 up to the New York Giants in New York. But just to add to what you're saying, he was also the greatest base runner. He was the smartest baseball player that I ever saw. He was when he was ready to play, there was nobody that could catch a ball in the outfield like he did. He got to jump on it. Everybody talks about the Vic Wertz catch. I saw that almost in person, not exactly in person, but I was outside the ballpark and going over with my father. And I'll tell you, Willie Mays, in my book, is the greatest player. Runs, hits, defense, everything, adapted his whole game when he went to Candlestick Park. He hit over 700 home runs if he stayed at the Polo Grounds in New York, but he had to switch his whole game to go to the Polo Grounds and still mastered the home run by going to right center field. Just a tremendous, tremendous player, and we'll talk more about him throughout the program this evening because a number of people have a comment that they're going to want to make. This afternoon, well, a couple of things. First afternoon, the Padres won their first game since June the 6th on the road. They beat the Phillies in Philadelphia 5-2. Phillies are now 49-25. The only team over them is in the American League. The Yankees have won 51 going into tonight's game against the Orioles. Harper had two home runs, number 16 and number 17. And as I said, the Phillies right now are 49-25. The game in Baltimore tonight, Roy, Judge is going to be out because he was hit by a pitch on the left arm, left hand, very undeserving. And Gerrit Cole is going to get his first start since coming off the DL. Your comments on those two subjects?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting. The baseball season has become an interesting one in terms of there's two classes. I mean, there's the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, you've got certainly the Phillies and the Dodgers and are right there in the haves group with the in the National League. And I think you could count the Braves in there, too, still. They're obviously trailing in a big way right now from the Phillies, but I still think they're good enough to be in that mix. And then over in the American League, you've got the Habs, you've got the Yankees, you got the Orioles, you've got well right now the Seattle Mariners, and I still think you have to count Texas in there too, maybe even Houston. But really, it's just, you know, it's an interesting season in terms of how. The division races really aren't there, except for possibly in the Centrals, certainly in the National League, where it's, you know, a bit of a scramble and not too many good teams, really. But the major interest has got to be in the wild card races. And, you know, beyond that, who in those wild card mixes can really test and give a game to some of those haves that I just mentioned, teams like the Yankees, teams like the Orioles, teams like Philadelphia. So interesting season the way it's measuring up, but hey, we're only about halfway through and not even there. So we'll see how it goes. But that's really what I've kind of, you know, I think everybody's seen it happen.
No question about that. Cleveland has stepped out a little bit. You know, they've got a 5-game lead going into tonight. And of course you mentioned Texas, the Rangers are really struggling between Houston and Texas. You know, they're nine games back of Seattle, which has gotten out to a great start. And everybody thought that, you know, the Rangers would be great again this year after winning. And we run through a couple of today. First of all, I said the Padres took the Phillies this afternoon. The Braves won 7-0, so they pick up a game on the Phillies, which is still a long way off for the Braves right now. Your Cubbies got a win 6-5 this afternoon over the Giants. The Marlins won 4-3 over the Cardinals. The Cardinals still struggling, but somehow they continue to be in the race. But Pittsburgh 1-0 over the Reds, and the Nationals won this afternoon very easily, beating Diamondbacks by a score of 3-1. Next comment quickly, Roy, from you. The Celtics rolled through the NBA championship, winning in 5, but it was really a nothing championship series. Only one game was under, I think, 14, 15 points. The Celtics really wanted it going away.
Yeah, they sure did. And, you know, proving that, you know, not a whole lot of intrigue in this NBA season. You know, the more the NBA, the more we watch it, the more we realize it's really about personal drama with individual players. As it has been for so many years, just a handful of teams that are really championship caliber. And this time around, it was the Celtics. They're back in that mix, you know, and boy, it wasn't even close. I mean, you could make the argument that they, you know, they basically set it up so they could win at home by not playing very hard at all in game four, and pretty much handled their business as they chose to see fit, depending on the night it was. So, I hear talk about, you know, possible dynasty. Well, you know, given the way they handled, this playoff run, you could make the argument. But then there were also some games where they, you know, like that game four, and they had a couple of those, a couple of clunkers. And I just, you know, maybe that's because they're so good that they, you know, they feel they can take a night off and still win. And then maybe they're surprised that they don't. But at the end of the day, it's a very strong team. And, you know, right now I'm not sure there's anybody in the East in the NBA that can really challenge them. The West a little bit tighter, but the Celtics are strong. And I can see them getting right back where they are this year, next year. So we'll see how it goes.
Roy, we'll step right into the National Hockey League, your belly work, and the Panthers, you had them closed all the way through from the Lightning series right on through, saying how well they were going to play against the Rangers, how the way they're going to play against the Lightning. And I'll tell you, right now we've got a big game coming up on Friday night at 8 o'clock. And so you tell me, how do you like them against the Oilers?
Yeah, I still like them. I still like them. I still think they're the better team. But I'll tell you what the Oilers have shown is that just there's danger there. There is real danger there, even when they're shorthanded. I mean, the first team ever to score the first goal back-to-back game shorthanded in the Stanley Cup Finals, and they go on to win both games. I mean, those are big momentum pushes for Edmonton, which doesn't need much of a push. You know, I think they figured out, Edmonton, that what they weren't doing in the first three games of this series, they weren't shooting the puck enough, and they weren't going to the net enough. And I think they realized that, you know, it's not a real scrappy team anyway. You take Evander Kane out, and it's far less scrappy. Zach Hyman's about, you know, one of the few guys that's going to go in there and play, you know, and do the dirty work. And so, you know, it's hard to score against a team like Florida if you're not willing to pay that price. And, you know, early on in this series, we saw that Edmonton wasn't really willing to pay that price. Well, if you're not going to pay that price, then you got to shoot the puck a lot. And you at least got to go to the net and try to get tip-ins and deflections and things like that. Well, they figure that out. And so the last two games, we've seen a much better Edmonton team, which, by the way, has played exceptionally well defensively. You know, I mean, Florida hasn't had it easy here. It's not like they blew anybody out early on. So,
right.
You know, easily Edmonds could have won that first game. And so they've given Florida some fits here. They've been extremely strong on the penalty kill. And that's, you know, something that we're a little bit, you know, I'm not surprised by it from Edmonton, but it's really not their style. Their style is really kind of, you know, just fluid motion and scoring off the rush, and you know, they haven't been able to do that as much against Florida because they can't, but they've adjusted well, and so now you're in a danger zone if you're Florida. Edmonton at home can have a big crowd obviously behind them. They've already got the momentum now, I think, in this series. It won't take much for them to get the momentum back in a game. As soon as you know, if they don't have it right off the bat, even if they're down by a goal or two, they can get it back pretty quickly. So I think this next game is going to be really interesting. And, of course, if that one goes Edmonton's way, well, then it's a complete toss-up. So it's been a great series. Hadn't gone the way I think a lot of people thought it would. You know, with the momentum shifts. But at the end of the day, it's been pretty interesting to see how Edmonton has adjusted over the course of the series. And now Florida's got its back against the wall a little bit. But I won't be surprised at all if Florida still comes out and wins this thing.
Roy, I'll tell you, I want to go back to your earlier conversations as the playoffs began. We talked about goaltending. We talked about goaltending against the Rangers. We talked about goaltending all the way through. And I'll tell you, the Panthers have gotten exactly that. Fantastic goaltending all the way through.
Yeah, they really have. Sergei Bobrovsky has been very sharp. And, you know, even in game four, you know, he was pretty strong early on. You give up a 2-on-1 break, and it turns in, you know, into a goal on shorthanded. Hard to blame the goalie for that. I mean, you know, the Oilers have shown off their skill is what they've done. You know, you look at the one of the goals last night. McDavid skates about 180 feet and makes just an incredible pass right in front of the net to Draisaitl, and you know, so. This is how Edmonton scores. So I think Bobrovsky's been strong. He's been consistent. He might have given up a couple of cheap ones late in his tenure in that game four before he was pulled. But at the end of the day, he's certainly given them what they need. And sometimes against Edmonton, your best just can't be good enough. And maybe that's been the case the last couple of games. But I still think he's good enough to shut down Edmonton. And, again, I'm not predicting it, but wouldn't surprise me at all to see him give up one or two goals tops in this next game or even over the course of the next two. I could certainly see him shutting out Edmonton in this next game or giving up a couple of goals and shutting him out in game seven. So we'll see how it goes.
Roy Cummings, our special guest, as always, in the first half hour, and Roger Hiller will be joining us from Atlanta. We've got a Hall of Famer coming on a little bit later on in the program that we'll chat about. But another sad note on the calendar, we talked about Willie Mays passing away late yesterday and into today. We also have to talk about Len Bias. If you're a college basketball fan, and of course most of us are, we grew up with the game almost from day one, and Len Bias was one of the great basketball players to come out of Maryland. First draft choice that was going to turn the franchise around again from a losing team to a winning team up in Boston with the Celtics. And unfortunately, an overdose of chemicals, and Len Bias never got a chance to play. Any comment on that one, Roy?
Yeah, just just very sad situation. It's something to remember that, you know, for some players, the NBA is not the pinnacle. For some players, you know, what they did in college is what defines them. And there's nothing wrong with that because, I hate to remember Len Bias for what happened in the NBA because there wasn't much there. But at the end of the day, he was a great college player. And there's a lot of players who are just great college players, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a great brand of basketball, and he did a lot for his school there. And so, kudos to Len Bias for putting together a tremendous career. It didn't quite work out in the NBA, and it's sad to see him go. But remember him for what he did in college because that was special. And not everybody, can make that transition. It shouldn't demean your career in any way. So I think Len Bias has proven that, what you do in college matters in a big way. And because always be remembered in Maryland as one of the greatest ever.
Also, Roy, we could talk a little bit about, and I don't know very much about, I've learned more in the last two or three days after what's been replenished down in Birmingham. When black baseball was a big part of America and a big part of baseball in its entirety, and now the records have been really established and move up against some of the players that played Major League Baseball all the way through their career. But they're going to have a game at a stadium that's been completely redone, united, and is honor all the black players that played not only for Birmingham but played in the entire league. They're still around. I think they have four or five that are going to throw out the first pitch. I have no recollection of that ballpark. I've seen it on television now that it's been redone. I know you're way younger than I am, Roy. Have you seen any of the clips that have been given to lead up to the ball game?
No, I haven't. But I know that it's going to be a celebration of the black the Negro leagues and rightfully so. I think for a long time what those players did as barnstorming teams more or less for so many years has been kind of forgotten, and there were great players there, and we can only speculate as to what some players could have done in the major leagues and things like that. So, but I'm glad that Major League Baseball has found a way to really add some spice to the regular season. Now, as baseball traditionalists like you and I are, Don, like Roger is, Frank is, look, we don't need much to get us to watch a baseball game. Two teams are playing, we're watching. And we're happy about it. But I think you can build the fan base through some of these special games that we're seeing. The games at the Field of Dreams field in Iowa. This game at Rickett Woods. The games in London. The games in Mexico City. I think these are something new and they're special, and you get a real special feeling about them. And I think the fact when you're taking the opportunity, the full opportunity to educate people on, what does this game really mean? What is it that we're celebrating here? You realize that there's a past in baseball that has somewhat been forgotten, overshadowed by the greatest stars, the Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, the Babe Ruths and the Ted Williams of baseball. And there's a lot of guys that did a lot of work to make this game popular in a lot of places, and that legend lives on down through generations now, thanks to their commitment to the game.
Roy, we'll hold it right there because we got a big show tonight, and I thank you as always very, very much, and we'll chat more about it next week as we have a little bit more time. But take care, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it as always.
Roy Cummings, our special guest, always the first half hour. We talked about Hall of Famers and a guy that could tell us a lot more about this game that's going to be played with the old Negro Stars. And because he worked in so many different football locker rooms and a Hall of Famer in the National. I just named the Hall of Famer of the National Hockey League, Darryl Ledbetter. He's down in Atlanta now. He covers all the Atlanta teams at this time. He started off in Green Bay. I thought Roger would be with us by this time to introduce Darryl because he and Darryl are great friends down there in Atlanta. But, Darryl, welcome to the show as always. And I'll tell you, congratulations on going into the Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you so much. Honored and humbled to be selected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame Writers Wing by the Pro Football Writers of America. And looking forward to the enshrinement ceremonies in Canton, Ohio.
Darryl, let me just go back to our last interview with Roy. And you probably know way more than I do about this reclamation of the ballpark in Birmingham and what they're going to do and the players that are still alive that are going to be there. Can you give us any insight on the baseball front before we get into more football?
The Ricketts Park is a historic park in Birmingham, just a couple hours to the east here. And, that's where Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and a lot of the old Negro League stars played at. And, they're going to have a tribute tomorrow. Ricketts Glen in Birmingham to honor some of the history of the baseball league, Major League Baseball history.
No question about that. And what a reclamation they did on that whole baseball complex down there. I don't know if you had a chance. I just asked Roy. He said he had not had a chance to see some of the TV clips that in preparation for tomorrow night. Have you seen any of them?
Yeah, I've seen the pictures, and it's kind of the old configuration. Reminds you of a Tiger Stadium off of Finkel Road in Detroit, with the everything up the right and the left sideline. It was made for football. You could play both in it. Kind of old school stadium, but it's definitely a throwback there. It's on 2nd Avenue right there in downtown Birmingham.
Well, let's go back to your bailiwick, which is the National Football League. As I said, so many years with the Green Bay Packers and the number of years you've been in Atlanta. Tell us what you think of the Atlanta draft, what you think of the preparation for the upcoming season.
Yeah, the Falcons will be one of the top contenders for the NFC South Division, which has been won by Tampa Bay for the last 3 years, and the Saints have been major competitors for them. So now the Falcons are looking to make a move up in the division after having a pretty good draft, and picking up some good pieces in free agency. They won't be getting a lot of help from their first-round pick as they drafted a quarterback right after they signed one in free agency. So they're trying to stabilize that position for the future. But then they went on the defensive side of the ball and drafted a bunch of defensive tackles and linebackers. Rook Robertson was the main one. Braylon Trice from Washington. J.D. Bertram from Notre Dame, so they went heavy defense and then got a receiver late from Illinois that could, jump really high and caught a few balls out there in the Big Ten. So it's a good-looking, solid draft. Can't be spectacular because you didn't really get help for the first-round pick. That's going to be immediate help when you draft the quarterback, Michael Penix Jr.
Hall of Famer, Darryl Ledbetter, our special guest in Atlanta, Georgia. And, Darryl, let's take one more step forward as we talk about not only the Falcons but and where they may wind up in the South, because it's a wide-open division right now, because I know that, we see what happens in Tampa all these years and whether we can keep that run going of 3 years into the playoffs. But When you look at it, you think New Orleans can make a little bit of a run again, as well as Atlanta, or how do you see the division?
Yeah, much like last year, you know, they all are the same, you know, 9-8, 10-8 teams. But you worry that the one thing Tampa Bay got last year was they won the division. They got in the playoffs, got a playoff win. And usually when teams get in there and get a taste of that playoff atmosphere, they come back a little bit more determined and so forth. So Tampa Bay is definitely the front runner. The Saints missed, and they're still trying to fix stuff with Derek Carr and so forth. And the defense, they got a new offensive coordinator down there. So they're going to be trying to do some new and different things. So it's a solid group. But, you know, they've come up short the last couple of years trying to overtake the Bucs. And the Falcons just, you know, they really going to turn on how healthy they are. Can Kirk Cousins come back and give you functional play at the quarterback position? Can Grady Jarrett make it back from his knee injury and solidify that defense and make it more of a force that, you know, they haven't been able to rush quarterbacks for a while? Got to stop the run first. So those two things will turn, you know, whether the Falcons are going to be legitimate contenders or not, if Kirk Cousins and Grady Jarrett are healthy.
Darrell, I've got to be very, very honest with you. I've been following football a long time in the National Football League since the very early days. I don't have any feel for these new rules. Tell me what you, as a veteran writer, both in Green Bay and now in Atlanta, Hall of Famer, do you have a feel for these new rules that they've incorporated to this year?
Yeah, I do. I was fortunate enough to be invited to the rules committee meeting in Indianapolis. And had it broke down. It was me and a select group of writers there with the defense special teams coordinator from Dallas and a few other special teams coaches and the rules committee, Troy Vincent and all those guys. So I got a pretty good film review of what it's going to look like, what they think it's going to look like. And at least the kickoff is going to be like more of a running play, more of an outside zone run where you're going to try to bust it through the weak part of the coverage unit. So you can't double team block, but if you get a win, you know, not a stalemate, and you knock a guy out of the hole, then the returner's going to have to hit that hole and get on up the field. So there'll be some opportunities for returns in that regard. The replay is going to be new. They're going to use more replay to help them get the calls right. And I think that's a good step in the right direction. They've got enough scientific data to support the use of more replay. You just don't want it to super slow the game down. And they think they're in a good place time-wise with the replays and so forth, too.
Well, I'm of the opinion that I always thought the kickoff was one of the most exciting parts of all football, whether it was college football, the pro game, or whatever. And they're trying to force the teams now to run the ball back because all they would do is kick it into the end zone or have a fair catch, and there really wasn't any reserve kicks for the majority of time in the National Football League. However, they also eliminated the fact that these players are going to be going at full speed, taking off of the 35-yard line in pursuit of the player that's going to be running the ball back, and that's going to stop the injury factor. Now, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. You don't have the full speed collision. You got kind of mini collisions at 10 yards. They can't go until the ball has been secured. So, you know, nobody's got to run ahead, start and run into a stationary player. You know, in the name of player safety, that's why the kickoff was taken out of the game because, you know, they had such violent collisions and concussions. At a high rate. They might still have them here, but they probably will be at a lower rate.
Darrell, do you still look at the Kansas City Chiefs as the number one team, maybe San Francisco second? How do you rate the season as we just get ready to go to camp?
Yeah, you know, I was going off of one of the 33rd team that rated all the top 10 rosters, and you know, they had San Francisco first, the Eagles second, Chiefs third, Ravens fourth, and I can't really argue with that. You know, the San Francisco, you know, Brock Purdy showed that he's worthy. You know, that he went toe-to-toe with Mahomes in the Super Bowl there. They should have ran the ball like Shanahan always should have done in these games. He manages not to do it. And then the Eagles, they fell off last year, but they still have talent, and they've got to be able to, you know, put that back together with Vic Fangio calling the defense. That will certainly help them. And then the Ravens, you know, they were there and then outsmarted themselves in the playoffs and tried to throw it 33 times and not run the ball. But they got Derrick Henry now. So, you know, those are the four teams, I think, going in. And the, you know, three of them are NFC teams. And in the NFC, you got to add in Dallas because, you know, as much as that has gone on down there, they have been 12-5 the last 3 years. Just haven't been able to figure it out in the postseason.
Well, it all comes down, Darryl, to quarterbacks. And the Philadelphia Eagles were very, very successful a couple of years ago with their quarterback. A young quarterback came in. They gave him a large, large extension and a long-term contract. And last year, not all his fault, but for some reason he just wasn't the same performer he was the year before.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, he he's got to be able to throw the deep ball to A.J. Brown and Jalen Smith. And then, you know, when people come up to stop the run, then he's got to, you know, either get it to the tight end or move it around. So he had a new coordinator, too, last year. So his coach had went to got a job with the Colts. So, you know, whoever they got in there now, the new coordinators, they got to put it back together and basically try to repeat what they did the previous year to get to the Super Bowl.
You make a key point for me each and every year, and that is that these teams that constantly switch coaches, and then they switch their offensive coordinator, then they switch their defensive coordinator. The players never get the opportunity to play 2 or 3 years under the same system. They have to reorganize every single year. And you just can't do that on a regular basis and win.
No, and I don't know why people don't copy the Steelers model. They believe in consistency. They don't really fire the coordinators once they're set in place. And, you know, when I was doing my coaching search this year, after Arthur Smith got fired, the Steelers have not had a losing season. They had one losing season in, like, the last 25. And, you know, 11 playoff appearances, only one Super Bowl. But they're consistently in that playoff hunt, and the NFC North are consistently going, even though they haven't won a playoff game in their last 5 trips. But, you know, consistency for them, New England, Green Bay, they stick with the same model and the same football system. And it's been a success for the Packers since 1992. They've been in the hunt. Each and every year, they've transitioned in and out of quarterbacks. Now it looks like for the third time. And then New England had Tom Brady for most of their run, so that might have been an outlier. But, yeah, I don't know why teams are not copying what works in the NFL. They say it's a copycat league, but they refuse to follow the Pittsburgh, Green Bay, and New England model.
And at the same time, everybody thought Dallas was going to make a change when they got knocked out of the playoffs early last year. Crabtree was going to go. And it did not turn out that way. However, Dallas, again, you talk about consistency, just about what you're speaking about. They get to the playoffs. They haven't done a great deal when they got there, but they certainly give the fans the fact that they're at the playoff level each and every year.
Yeah, and it's on Coach McCarthy. He's one of the Packer coaches, so they are trying to follow that motto. To get this team ready. I mean, they got punched in the mouth last year by the Packers running the ball against the smallest defensive front, which, you know, you had to anticipate, you know, and maybe you should have went bigger if you could, even if you got to go into the practice squad. But they weren't ready to play, and that game was over early. It was 21-0 before you were done with your first beer. And so they got to get ready. Got to get them ready to play in the playoffs. And they should know by now that it's a whole different ball game than the regular season.
Lawrence has had a chance to get his feet on the ground now. He's been injured a couple of times, unfortunately, at very bad times in the season. But he's got himself a contract that is very, very lucrative. and he's now really a senior citizen of the league. How do you rate him now?
Yeah, very average. I've been following Trevor since his eighth grade year. You know, he was making the news regularly every Friday night. You'd look to see his five or six touchdown passes and then follow him at Clemson. You know, knowing that Peyton Manning started slow and got better as he went along, you kind of wanted to see Trevor kind of improve here. And we really haven't seen that improvement yet. It's been steady, but it hasn't been spectacular. And I think they may have overpaid on this contract extension. It would have been no trouble for me to say, hey, do it again. Do it next year. Get us back to the playoffs and win a game or two before we give you $240 million.
Darryl Ledbetter, just nominated. He'll be going into the Hall of Fame, one of the great writers of the National Football League, and joins us every once in a while. And it's a pleasure to talk to him. And we talked about Lawrence, but we also could talk about a couple other quarterbacks that fall in that same category. Darryl, you know, give us a couple other quarterbacks that came in young and just haven't really done what you thought they were going to do consistently yet.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem up in Cleveland, they gave up three first-round picks and guaranteed $240 million for Deshaun Watson. He started off good in Houston, but then, you know, things went sideways there, and now injuries have come on. So you don't really know which way he's going. You know, there are a lot of guys around the league. Sam Darnold's bounced around the league. He's got talent, but maybe they could save him in Minnesota like Baker Mayfield was saved by Dave Canales in Tampa Bay. So, Trent, you know, there have been a lot of other guys, too. The young man that was with San Francisco got traded to Dallas out of North Dakota State, Trey Lance. He's the interesting one to see if, you know, they can develop him. There's got to be some patience with these young quarterbacks that we haven't seen in the league. You know, Green Bay set Jordan Love for 3 years. What team wants to do that now? But that's what they needed to do to get him ready to play. And he paid them off last year with a big playoff push and so forth. So those are some of the young guys who have done good, some that are still trying to find their way. And we'll see because all the old heads are gone. There's opportunities for guys to take over in this league. But the teams have just not been willing to develop them. We'll see how Kyler Murray does out in Arizona here with his, I think, third or fourth coordinator. But we'll see how they try to develop and get these younger players to play a little bit better at the game's biggest position.
Darryl, the one thing that shows consistency that you're talking about is the Cleveland Browns. I mean, unbelievable. They have Cleveland and Chicago have had enough quarterbacks in the last 5 years to take care of 18 teams.
Yeah, no doubt. They've had a problem getting that right ever since the Ravens left and they came back into the league. If Deshaun is not ready to go this year, they do have Jameis Winston. That roster is so talented that Joe Flacco took them to the playoffs last year, but they ran into C.J. Stroud, the Houston Texans, who is, one of the young guys we're expecting to see continue to do better. That's a tough situation for the Browns.
Let's start over your top.
I wanted to jump in here before it's too late to talk to my good friend D. Litt. And a couple of things, Arthur Blank and Matt Ryan going into the circle of excellence. And for the Falcons, you may have spoken about this, but I do want to personally thank you, Pro Football Hall of Fame. Couldn't be a better writer or a person. And I love Matt's retirement greeting to you. This is the last time you will be the first to ask a question, be led. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, Roger, thanks a lot. Yeah, that was hilarious, and congratulations. We did talk about the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and humbled and honored for sure. And Matt and Arthur Blank are going in the ring of honor at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium on separate games, though. But Matt Ryan, perhaps the greatest Falcon ever to play the game, certainly the best quarterback with the most wins. I always get the Michael Vick and Steve Bartkowski people upset when I say that. But he did win the most, and he did take them to the playoffs the most. And he's only one of two quarterbacks to take him to a Super Bowl, and the other one was Chris Chandler. So little kudos to Matt, and that's going to be a good day at the stadium when they put him in the Ring of Honor.
Well, Darryl, absolutely. Congratulations once again, and we really appreciate every time you take the time to join us. And we'll get you on here real soon when that football season gets underway, and we really appreciate it very much. And congratulations again from everybody on our staff. We're going into the Hall of Fame, and we'll be looking forward to seeing that film ourselves. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Darryl. You're the best, man.
All right. You too, Roger.
All right. We're going to swing over to UFL now right now and talk a little bit with Trevor Basso, because Trevor has been covering the USL for since day one that it started, and shows you that someone from American's Samoa can spend, if you got enough patience and you got enough time and you work hard enough and you're from Samoa, you can even get into the UFL. So now you're getting into the National Football League. How about that, Trevor?
Yeah, no, it was a really good season that we just saw. The conclusion of it was really nice. Definitely not the game I was expecting when it came to the Brahmas not scoring a point. Wade Phillips definitely was scratching his head after that one. The Birmingham Stallions have won their third championship in a row, so they make history. That was awesome to see. But yeah, it was really fun to see that and to see the conclusion of the inaugural season.
Well, I want to go back for a minute, because when I talked about America Samoa, I'm talking about a young man that was just signed by the New York Jets. An outstanding player, 335 pounds on the offensive line, plays center and guard. And he signed yesterday with the Jets. He came out of Hawaii and really has worked his way through a number of pro teams before he finally now at 25 is getting his first opportunity. And so we'll see whether I don't know that many players that came out of America Samoa, Cole Levaro is one, L-E-V-A-R-O, and he's now signed by the New York Jets. How about him? You saw him in the league all year.
Yes. Yeah, San Antonio, they did some good things on the ground. Their offensive line was pretty solid throughout the season. Obviously, with a coach like Wade Phillips, you'd hope to see that. I think Wade Phillips is for sure doing a lot of networking for his team and a lot of the players in the league. Having a reference from him definitely does wonders. It's really good to see players getting signed to NFL teams. I think there's already 8 or 9. That's awesome to see.
Roger, are you still on, or are you a lot of noise back
here.
There?
Go ahead. I think we're losing Trevor a little bit in and out. Or I don't know if it's me or not. But who was the tremendous corner for the Steelers? I think he was from he was from the American Samoa, wasn't he? The Steelers cornerback.
What's all the background noise here? What's going on here?
We're getting all this interference. We can't hear. Trevor, are you there?
Yeah,
Trevor.
I can hear you guys. It's not from me.
Now I can hear
I don't
you
know
clearly.
What's going on.
Yeah, I don't either. Now I can hear you clearly. Can you hear us, Don?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's clear now. Okay. What about
I don't
that
know what
player?
Go ahead, Roger.
What about that? What about the guy? I read that article too, Don, in the Post about this young man. What about him, Trevor? you said that Wade Phillips is the guy pushing a lot of the players. Is he one of them, and is he the first of many or several that will be signed in the NFL from the UFL?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a head coach of a team in a spring league, you got to do your due diligence to push your players and try and get them to that next level. Wade Phillips is for sure that type of guy.
Do you expect a large number of players who, because the way they put it out in the post, as Roger said, and I saw the same thing, this is the first player ever coming out of America Samoa to sign to the National Football League. And can we expect, I mean, this is quite, they say he does not have much of a chance to make the team because the Jets have spent so much money in the offseason boosting their offensive line, but they wanted to give him a chance at 300, and, I think it was 25 or 335 pounds. So you expect we're going to see not necessarily American Samoa, but, you know, a great number of players being signed. I have not seen it. This first player that I have actually seen signed.
Yeah, I would hope so. I would expect close to 50, maybe even 60 players get signed to the NFL. Like you said, probably not making the final roster, but at least making practice squad.
Roger?
Trevor, yeah, looking back on this season, 10 games plus the playoffs, was there any team or any Dallas team players that surprised you that produced more than you maybe expected at the beginning of this year, this season?
I definitely was disappointed with Memphis in its entirety, Houston as well, but very impressed by San Antonio. They were the least favored team to get to the championship game. Now, they didn't score a single point, and they looked outright pathetic on the field. And Wade Phillips definitely didn't call his best game as a head coach. I blame a lot of it on A.J. Smith, their offensive coordinator. But San Antonio as a whole definitely did some good things this year during the regular season. But mainly just Birmingham making history is probably the staple of this league. And honestly, the most impressive thing by far is Skip Holtz and Zachary Potter putting together that dynasty, winning 32 games and only losing 4 in 3 years, winning 6 playoff games, not losing 1 game in the postseason. 7 out of their 12 games this year were comeback wins. The Birmingham Stallions, honestly, are the topic of discussion when it comes to springtime football, in my opinion.
What's on the drawing board? What are the main, give me the main 4 or 5 items that are on the drawing board now for the league?
Building home team fan bases, marketing, consolidation, stuff like that.
Roger?
Okay, now the spring football, the UFL had its first season under its belt. What do you do now, like with your successful podcast going forward? What exactly, how are you going to go after the NFL? You're going to college, high school? What are your plans now for you?
Well, our podcast is about, you know, sports, film, music. We have plenty of topics of discussion that we kind of continuously go over. The UFL definitely is a big part of it, but, you know, it has an off season like everything else. So, you know, kind of a perfect time, you know, to segue and then, you know, raise or, you know, just other stuff like that, especially, you know, with what's coming up in the NFL, getting ready for that off season. But yeah, you know, there's always something to talk about, luckily.
Trevor, are you looking forward to more teams in the league next year? Are you looking forward to this off season having an opportunity to get more of a line on where the league is going to go, where their television contracts are, all the things behind the scenes not just the players or the coaches. I imagine there are going to be a number of coaching changes too. Is that right?
Yeah, I imagine Wade Phillips is done. I imagine some of the poverty teams will also have some staffing changes like Memphis, Houston, and Arlington. But overall, yeah, no, I think it was a successful league. And I don't think they're definitely not expanding next year like
okay.
You know, I would like. But, you know, I think it's trending in the right direction with just slowly building, slowly but surely.
Trevor, thank you very, very much for this segment. Another good one on the UFL. We'll be following it all during the offseason with you. And we're going to move to Trent, New Jersey, the College of New Jersey. And we have a fellow that's in his car right now that's going to introduce Sharon to us and what she means to the world of lacrosse. Roger.
Well, I'll tell you what. She's not only a great Hall of Fame lacrosse field hockey coach, wonderful mother, great individual, a friend for many, many years. Sharon Pfluger, this is a real pleasure to have you on the show tonight. Believe me.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice, Roger. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll tell you, Sharon, you and I go back many years when I was doing radio in Princeton and followed your exploits, and I'll never forget, I was telling Don and Frank that I remember when I was out at Indianapolis for the Super Bowl one year, and I went over to the NCAA headquarters and took the tour, and there I saw your school, your college's banner up there for winning the national championship, which they do for every champion, every sport, every division. And I remember how tickled you were about that. But talk about your career, what it's like to be the head coach of two esteemed, successful programs at the College of New Jersey.
Well, you know, I've done this for so long, but I still feel that it's an honor for me to be able to do this. I love the College of New Jersey, and we have wonderful young ladies who are very good students, who work so hard, and we have a great administration, and it's just a good feeling to be a part of something so special.
Well, my wife taught there for a great number of years at the College of New Jersey, and we were, of course, a part of the fact when they wanted to change it from Trent State to the College of New Jersey, and then Princeton wanted to complain about that. Wanted to put a lawsuit up. They said they were the College of New Jersey, but the College of New Jersey won the suit, and the College of New Jersey stands. But how about Sharon? How about a recruiting? How tough is it to recruit?
Well, recruiting, it's just it's a whole another full-time job, I think, for any college coach. And for the College of New Jersey, I mean, there are good students very strong students that want to be at the college. And it's just a matter of, you know, finding the right fit. And for us, really, it's getting them on campus and letting them get a feel of what the campus is like, what we're like. And it's just, it's year-round, you know. And it's, with both sports, there's a lot of overlap right now because of the club programs are so serious. But it's good. It works, you know. It works out every year.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, Sharon, it's interesting. My cousin has three daughters. They're all grown. And one went to Hunt, and the other ones went to Montgomery High School. And the one that went to Hunt transferred from Washington and Lee and just is like the biggest promoter of the College of New Jersey. And,
just a second, Roger. We got that background noise again. Hold a second. I give Frank a chance to clear up the background noise so that we can hear what Sharon has to say. Okay, now we're better off. Go ahead, Roger.
But I know the SAT scores that are required at the PCNJ are very high, and I'm sure that has a big effect on your recruiting, doesn't it?
Yeah, enormous effect. In fact, you know, there are many times where we had these outstanding students, their GPAs were so high, but maybe they didn't get you know, over 1,200 or higher on their SATs or the equivalent of the ACT. And that was very challenging. Through the pandemic, we became test optional, which has been very nice. We're still getting wonderful students, but there's a little more give where we can see, you know, the student that takes the AP classes and is doing so well. And if their ACTs or SATs are really high, we say, yeah, send them in. And if they're not happy with them, we say, don't send them in. so that's been like, you know, there's so many hard things that came out from the pandemic, but that, you know, was something that I think is working in our favor, to be very honest.
John, one of the things that a lot of folks listening all around the country, because we transmit everywhere, but give everybody an opportunity to know exactly what the campus is. How many students at the campus? How long have you been coaching there at the College of New Jersey? And go from there.
All right. Well, let's see. There are about 6,500 to 7,000 undergrad students amongst the campus on a daily basis. It's a nice sized population. It's not too small. It's not too big. It's really a nice, comfortable size for many students. I think I'm going on my 40th year here. When I say it, I can't even believe it. I got the job. It's just like, where did those years go by, you know?
Well, you were only 7 years old when you started, right?
Right. That's right.
I think I was. I think I was super young. And, you know, my whole life, really, my whole adult life has been here. I went to college here and from 78 to 82. And then for three years, I went back to North Jersey where I live, where my parents lived. And I was teaching, and I just happened to get a lot of college coaching jobs while I was teaching in the public schools and whatnot. And my fourth year out of school, I came back to coach. So all I know is this college, and it's home for me, and the whole area is home for me. It's a beautiful campus. The college just keeps getting better and better. Everything,
Roger,
is pristine.
Yeah. It is, and I was by there 'cause 6-8 months ago. Your daughter went to Hopewell Valley, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and then I believe that she played for you. I think I'm right about that.
Yeah, it's been a really neat experience. She did. She played for us for 4 years, and she was a freshman when the pandemic hit. So she was able to get that extra year of eligibility this past year. So she ended up starting her master's. She graduated with a kinesiology and health science degree and now is getting her MBA. And she played her extra year in lacrosse this year. So it's been a really cool journey. And she's a very cool, calm kid. So, you know, if anybody came to practice and they saw us out there, you would never know she was my daughter. She just fit right in, and it was great. She grew up on the field, so that was really nice. But it's been a really fun journey.
Sharon, what drew you to lacrosse? Because you know, you're talking, as you say, with your daughter having played there for you for 4 years, or actually 5 years. What drew you initially, that many years ago, to the game of lacrosse?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. So in high school, I played field hockey, basketball, softball. I ran the boys' track team 1 year. We didn't have lacrosse up in North Jersey at the time, you know. And then I went to college, and I had this awesome coach, Melissa McGee, and she was the first full-time field hockey and lacrosse coach at the college. It's just that year, my rookie year, my freshman year was her rookie year. And really, long story short, all the girls that were from South Jersey, if they played field hockey, they played lacrosse. And it used to be in the colleges, you know, if you play field hockey, you played lacrosse. So the coach was the same. The funny thing about lacrosse for me was that randomly I did a research paper in high school on the sport of lacrosse. So So I knew the whole history of the game and how it started and how it evolved to that point. So it wasn't so unfamiliar to me to hear about lacrosse. And then I ended up playing it. It was so wild, really. It's just so wild. And it was great. You know, it was really great. And for years, we turned field hockey players into lacrosse players, and I was one of those players. So I knew how to do that as a player, so I felt confident that I could encourage those who played field hockey to also play lacrosse. And some of them were All-Americans in lacrosse before they were All-Americans in field hockey. It was really wild, really special.
Roger?
Yeah, years ago I had Gail Saylor. She's the retired Princeton coach. And
yeah.
I think, yeah. And it was so ironic. I was obviously doing the coach's corner. And I said, you know, my high school had lacrosse for boys, but they had to play like college JV teams because there weren't that many. And she said, you know, my school was the same way. Now, obviously, she came after me by a number of years. But anyway, make a long story short, she went to Haverford High School, as did I, and her father was the industrial arts teacher there when I was there. And I read that she has since retired from Princeton. And as I recall, the men and the women, that was the first national championship in, I guess, any sport, right, by one university at the same time.
Yeah, pretty cool. And what a wonderful career she had at Princeton. She was a fantastic coach, really, and person, too.
Well, yeah, she was. She really was. Let me ask you this, because I asked John Wooden many years ago when I was out at UCLA what he considered his greatest team of all those championships. He wouldn't answer me. And I was wondering, I'll ask you the same question. With all your championships in each sport, what is there one team that you feel stands out in your mind more than any other?
You know, no. I really would have the same answer. I couldn't pick one team. I definitely couldn't pick one team. I think really what stands out to me the most is moments. You know, these wonderful moments that you have with individual players and teams when it's all clicking for them and you can see it clicking for them. And like we're on the same page and we're working so hard to achieve the same goal. So it's really all about those really special moments that we have with many teams and many players. And I think overall, not to go off on a tangent from your question, Roger, it's just, I look at our alum and I'm so amazed by them and what they did in our programs. And I'm just so proud of them, you know, and very close to them too.
Sharon, we've had a day, all day, talking about Willie Mays, the greatest baseball player of all time, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You must have had two or three players that stepped a little bit ahead of everybody else out of all these years. Any one particular or two particular players or even three that you like to single out that you think really were just a shade above others?
Wow. I probably, if I start mentioning some, I'll probably not stop. But Gina Carey from Florence, New Jersey was just fantastic. You know, she's a phenomenal athlete, and I was told I was never going to get her. And after a year at Ohio State, she called me up. She's like, Coach, I'm coming home, you know. And, you know,
wow.
Lee Mitchell, Leni Noto, Melanie Visosky, Tiffany Trockenbrod, you know, players that, like, tipped it over the edge, you know. Lindsey Hatch, then we had her sister, Jess Hatch, Nancy O'Neill, Kathleen Filippello. I mean, I should probably stop because I don't want to miss anybody because there are so many of them. Deanna Knobloch, you know, Lee Moreau. I, you know, really could go on and on in both the sports. I mean, Heidi Schwartz, Robin Phelps, who's my full-time assistant coach. I mean, these are phenomenal, phenomenal young ladies who were these tremendous athletes that they just wanted to play, you know.
Well, that's terrific. Nice to have that many people that you can put your finger on and say they were just a step above. Roger?
Well, the other thing is you have had a number of players that have gone on to coach. I'm sure you just mentioned a few of them. But I think that says something about you. And when they want to coach, you know, I've told Don this many times. One of the best times in my life was 2 years I coached, the Nottingham girls basketball AAU team. And it was wonderful. I mean, you know, because you had girls that just wanted to play the game. And you never had to worry about them. They were at practice. They were at, we were at Baltimore at the Inner Harbor, told them, be back at 2:30. They were there before 2:30. And, maybe mention a couple of your graduates, your alumni that are now coaching. High school or college?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, they're really starting to come into the college ranks now. But so many of them were, like, my South Jersey girls, they were coaching against each other down there. They're like, coach, it's like TSC and TCNJ versus TSC and TCNJ. We're doing the same thing, you know. It's like Deanna Knobloch. She was coaching at Morristown High School for many years. She had numerous state championships. The Schwartz sisters, Heidi and Robin Schwartz, were down there. Sandy Stockel's down there. Erin Waller, Nancy O'Neill. I mean, it could go on and on. They're just Megan McCall. They filled all of the high schools down there. It's been really wonderful. And then we spread out to, you know, like the Shore area when they picked up lacrosse, and now they're out there coaching. And North Jersey, it's just wild. And now they're starting to get into the college ranks, a lot of these young ladies now that are graduating. They're saying, you know, we graduated in a certain field, but we want to coach. So now we just have a head coach at Hartford University, Kane. I have a coach there. They're all over the place, really. They're graduate assistants or assistant coaches. It's really neat. And I think
they want to
come
back and beat you.
Yeah, of course they do. Of course they do. Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, I have a field hockey game in the beginning of September, and one of our young coaches just got the sales job. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, we're going to be coaching against her. But, you know, I always wish the best for the girls. Like, they know I'm always with them, you know, and they're so excited. In fact, one said the other day, we were out recruiting together, and she said, you know, I can't believe we're playing each other. And she said, underneath my shirt, I'm going to be wearing a TCNJ shirt. You know, they're just like, they're so into it. And I think, like, they're out coaching. But I think one of the most special things that I've encountered is I am now coaching some of their daughters, which is, like, I could never imagine that could have ever happened. And that's been a wild experience. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like players that were freshmen or, you know, sophomores and above, they're my first year, are now sending their daughters to us. So it's pretty cool.
Roger, before we get down to Mike Shipko, I'll let you finish out this with, and we'll see whether we can get a couple of recruits for her.
Well, hey, listen, she knows that I've already started down here in Georgia. And, you know, I told her, Don, West Forsyth came in. They lost in the state championship. And after I talked to you, Sharon, I wanted to tell you, Erin Brown called me. She just got back from vacation. So she's got your number, and she is going to go over the whole roster and talk about TCNJ. And you know what I really think?
Roger, hold on, Roger. We gotta wind this segment up.
Okay. Take it. Sharon, God bless. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone. Thanks, Roger. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you were great. Thank you so much, is right. Thank you so much. Mike's standing by right now, and I imagine he's a little bit worn out because soccer came on at 9:30 this morning, and the last game will be played at 11 o'clock tonight or 11:30 tonight. So he's got about a 12 or 14-hour day watching soccer. Mike, good to have you with us as always. Was it soccer today, or did you work today or just watch games?
Well, I mean, fortunately, all of this goes on during winter break. So,
Wait a minute. We got the background noise again. I can't hear anything you're saying. Okay.
I said, fortunately, this all goes on during summer break for me. So, you know, I can wake up at 9 and watch soccer until whenever and enjoy myself. But, you know, if I don't know what I would have had to do if I was working. But, yeah, it is a lot of soccer. It is a lot of soccer. We've got the European Championships going on. We've got MLS still happening. The Union are playing tonight. And then starting on Friday, we have the first games of the Copa America, which will be starting up, too. So just tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of soccer. You can start at 9 o'clock and watch almost all the way up until about 11 o'clock or midnight.
What do you lean toward more? Is there a particular style
right
of...
Well, I've been watching most of the year. I've been watching European Championship games because that's the
right.
International Championship. We're through the first round in a couple of games. I guess the biggest surprise would be Slovakia picking up the 1-0 win, their first at the Euros in quite a while. That was a big, I think, over Belgium. That was the biggest upset. Belgium ranked number 3 in the world. Not that the rankings mean a ton, but Belgium ranked number 3 in the world, and Slovakia ranked 48th. So that was a big win for them. The Scots had an absolutely horrible performance in the first game, losing 5-1 to the Germans, but they came back and acquitted themselves. Portugal left it late, but won yesterday. So there's been a lot of games that have been. Oh, Albania were kind of unlucky not to get a draw in their first game against Italy and not to win today against Croatia. They've been really good. There's been some really good teams. And some really good games. Turkey yesterday was a good one, too. So I'm really enjoying it.
Roger?
Well, you know, you talk about the Union and, United lost the they won the other day. And we were talking to Darrell Ledbetter earlier because a lot's been said locally because Arthur Blank is going into the circle of excellence at Mercedes-Benz Stadium for the Falcons, but mainly for overall all of his endeavors. And, it would be nice to see him get an MLS championship, in the next couple of years. And what do you think, looking into the future, because you really are on top of things, what does it look like to you where there's prospects, or is prospect to win the MLS in the next couple of years for the United? But the other thing is, I think soccer changes so much, Mike, every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, remember, he's got one. He did win one their second year in the league, when they had Joseph Martinez and Miguel Almiron, they won a championship. They hosted the MLS Cup Finals and they won. So he's got one.
Yeah.
As far as the prospects go, I've been a little bit surprised at just how willing he has been to stay with Carlos Bocanegra for as long as he has, is running the front office, because they just haven't had the success I think that they want. So the prospects in the next couple of years, you know, I think the prospect is always there. It doesn't take much for a team to pick up a couple of players and become relevant. They do have a model which looks like, you know, buying younger, sometimes a little more expensive than their opponents, but buying younger South American players. They haven't been a team that's necessarily gone out and gotten the big European star like a Lionel Messi. They've chosen to buy players that they feel like they can sell on. It's worked with Miguel Almirón. Some of the guys that they've gotten in, Ezequiel Barco and such since, it hasn't necessarily been as effective for them. I think that it is a model that is, can work, but it all depends on the players that you get, right? You got to buy the right guys, and their scouting has not necessarily been as effective. I think that's the case with the Philadelphia Union. Like, Ernst Tanner came in, and he was getting guys like Ty Wagner and to come in, Griezmann, and so all these guys that were coming in who were basic hits, and then the last couple of transfer windows, he hasn't had the same success rate.
Mike, if there's one thing that's consistent in every sport is, do you get the right people at the head? I mean, you look at the National Football League, you look at baseball, you look, I don't care what sport it is, soccer, you got to have the right people at the top. Otherwise, you know, you can do all the soliciting and selling and everything you want to do, but if you don't win, you don't stay. And how about in soccer? Is it that tough?
They've changed coaches. They haven't found the right coach recently to be able to take them to the success that they want. So I'm wondering if, you know, there's only so many times your general manager can fire the coach before you start to wonder if the problem isn't the general manager. And I'm not a guy who wants to see, who advocates strongly for people to lose their jobs, but I also know that this is a league that's measured in success. Success is determined by wins. You have a very clear picture at the end of the season whether or not you have had a successful season. And to be honest, the last three or four seasons for Atlanta United cannot be considered successful because they haven't won enough. They haven't been in the playoffs. They haven't really been in contention. So I'm thinking, like, something at some point soon quickly has to change, and the only place that you can change might be the front office. I definitely think that they have an opportunity to win an MLS Cup in the next couple of years, you know, even with the combination of Messi and those guys down at Inter Miami, you know, they're not going to be there that much longer. I would say in the next 3 or 4 years, we've seen it doesn't take long to build a team, and a team can go from kind of outside looking in to the top of the league pretty quick. And Atlanta is an attractive destination for a lot of people, and Arthur Blank has shown a willingness to pay what he wants to. So I definitely think that is a really long way of saying I definitely think that they have every opportunity to be successful.
But again, right back there, they got to have the top people that know who to draft and who to get and where to get them and how much you're going to pay them and all the rest. Roger, you're up.
Well, it's the old expression, don't hire someone you can't fire. Excuse me. And, you know, the good old boy network, you got to have, like Don, you're right. You have to have the right people from the top on down. And excuse me, I think George Steinbrenner was a perfect example of that. I mean, he got involved, but he also had a lot of good people working for him. And any good organization, I think, you know, the Patriots with Belichick. You know, soccer is no different than any other sport. The getting back to the European and also the games that are going to be played here coming up. Mike, will you be able to get out to see any of the games that are going to be played here in the States?
I'm going to try and go. Really, the closest ones are in New Jersey, so we're going to try and go up there and catch ones. Definitely, it'll be a little bit easier when they do the when the World Cup, because there'll be a couple of games in Philly. But
right,
we're going to try and get out and see them. There's been the warm-up games this past weekend with Argentina and Guatemala. That was a lot of fun. So it's been really interesting. I do enjoy it The last time that this tournament was in the States was the first time that this particular tournament had held outside of South America. And so it was a really big draw. It seems like this time, either they're not promoting it as well, or, you know, I would say that they're not having as much luck promoting it, because I can't believe that a lot of people would be uninterested in seeing this collection of teams play if they're soccer fans. It's just been, the tickets are a little bit expensive, I mean, which is also a problem. So they're having trouble selling it. They haven't been able to sell as many tickets. So that could be a bit of an issue. So if you want to, if there's a game around and you want to go see it, it looks like there's still good seats available.
I was going to ask you yesterday, with Trevor, we talked about the UFL a minute ago. He went all the way down to Birmingham with his granddad to see the championship rounds. And my question to him at that time, well, how were the television ratings and how was the turnout at the gate? And you're basically saying the same thing. How is the turnout at the gate going to be, and how are the television ratings going to coincide with that?
The television ratings are going to be interesting. I suspect that it'll do pretty well on television, provided that Fox doesn't ship it. One of the big issues that we've had with the European Championships thus far is some of the games have been on Fubo TV behind a subscription paywall. And that's just not – I don't understand that practice. I don't understand how you have the rights to an international tournament, even if you don't think it's the premier matchup of the day. Yesterday, the 12 o'clock matchup was Turkey. And Turkey and Georgia. And it turned out to be one of the best games of the tournament thus far. Some really great goals, a lot of back-and-forth play. It was a really exciting game. And Fox TV didn't broadcast it on Fox or FS1 or even FS2. They put it on Fubo TV because, I don't know, I guess from, you know, 9 till or 12 to 1, they had to show repeat to the Bassmasters Classic.
Well, the same problem. The Yankees are all with the Orioles tonight, but they're on Prime. You got two teams in first place, or relatively close to tied for first place in the American League East. And what do? They put it on Prime where you can't see it unless you're a Prime customer.
And that's the matter of follow the money, always the dollars. But I did see a game the other day on FS2. Mike, you probably saw. I forget what it was, but I watched it for a while. And but I think Fox does a pretty good job overall of their production, just like we had said with Trevor, that, you know, they were far superior to ESPN ABC on the UFL. And I think Fox does a better job on everything than the other networks.
I think they do a good job with the overall production. I would say that their studio team and their analysts I'm not always the biggest fan of. I wasn't the biggest Landon Donovan fan when he was playing. I haven't seen anything commentating wise that changes my opinion. I just think, in between, NBC to me has probably one of the best soccer pregame shows. Their Premier League morning shows is really, really good. And I would say Derek Ray, who does Bundesliga soccer for PN, would be the best commentator. And you're not really going to hear either one of them. We all were talking about him at the game that I was watching, and he's kind of like, he's got that Bob Shepherd in him. This is a guy, Derek Ray, who's commentating in the German league. He's a Scottish guy. He gets the FIFA pronunciation game guide at the beginning and memorizes that thing cover to cover, because there is never a name, no matter how strange it could be, that this guy can't pronounce perfectly.
Let me just say, before we run out of time, I know that Frank told me before we went on, you want to chat a little bit about the greatest baseball player, in my view, of all time that passed away yesterday, Willie Mays. And also, we talked in the early part of the show, first 15 minutes or so, about the game tomorrow night in Birmingham. And maybe you could tell us about both of those things. We'll start with Willie Mays first.
Well, I mean, of course, what can you say? Probably, you already said it, the best player to ever play. I, unlike you all gentlemen, did not get a chance to see him play really ever. No.
Let me interrupt you. Let me interrupt you for a second. In 1950, the Trenton Giants, I lived, raised in Trenton, New Jersey. The Trenton Giants were the first pro team that he played for. I was 7 years old. He played at Dunfield in Trenton. I saw him play many times before he came up to the Giants
wow.
in New York.
Wow, that's amazing.
He got his start as a Negro League player in Alabama playing with his dad's team when he was just a teenager, and he was playing semi-pro ball against grown men, and he had something to him. I always found it funny that, you know, they were a couple of dollars off on the negotiations, and he could have ended up a Brooklyn Dodger. If you could have imagined having a team that would have had him, Roy Campanella and Jackie Robinson all on it. That could, I think Monty Irvin played for them as well.
Yes, he played for the Giants. Giants.
Yeah, but he was
Monty Irvin.
Branch Rickey was going to sign him, but at the time they had a rule. They could only have they wouldn't sign an unofficial rule that said you couldn't sign more than three black players. So he didn't end up getting into to Brooklyn. He ended up going to New York. And plays his whole entire career pretty much with the Giants. I wonder how many more home runs he might have hit if he hadn't played in San Francisco for all those years, hit into that wall of wind coming off the bay and Candlestick Point. But just, you know, you talk about probably the most famous play in baseball history, the catch. And it wasn't necessarily just that he makes this catch in deep center in that, like, abyss that was deep center field and polo grounds, is the fact that he turns around and makes a throw that keeps the run from scoring. So just an amazing player and a great ambassador for the game. You never saw Willie Mays playing without a smile. He just always looked like he was enjoying the game and he was happy to be a part of it. And he just a great all-around person. And a big, so it was a big loss for baseball today, here in the news that he passed.
Tell us a little bit about this ballpark that they've totally reconditioned at Birmingham, and they've shown a number of clips leading up to tomorrow night's game. I've seen many of them, and everybody I've talked to tonight has never seen any of them. I can't believe it, but it's unbelievable. It's going to be a monumental thing tomorrow night.
Yeah, I guess it's the other version of, you know, they're not. I don't think they can do the Field of Dreams game this year because they're remodeling the stadium out there. So this kind of takes the place of it. We're playing at an old traditional Negro League stadium in Birmingham, Alabama, that they have managed to reconfigure. The stadium's been around since, I believe it's the early 20th century, and various forms and fashions.
It's the oldest ballpark in the United States, I've been told.
According to their records, it's the oldest ballpark in the United States. So they're redeveloping. Major League Baseball is helping to redevelop it. And they've committed to playing a couple of games down there. You know, they did this we've seen them do this before at Williamsport with the Field of Dreams game, now with this. And it's great that we're going to have this kind of heritage classic that's going to go on. The teams are going to wear traditional Negro League uniforms. So it's going to, again, just like we've talked about, bring attention back to the history and of the Negro Leagues. And when you think about just all of the great ball players past, in the distant past and even into the near past, who played in that Birmingham, Mobile, in that Alabama area, in Alabama, who got their starts down there, it's just, you know, you can just start naming the list of Hall of Famers, the greatest of all time, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, even up to somebody like Bo Jackson was from Alabama playing baseball in that area. So a lot of great ball players have gotten their start in that area, and this will just put, so it's not just about, you know, remembering the Negro Leagues, but also just how the contributions of that Mississippi, Alabama area to baseball as a whole, because it, we'll hear about just all the legendary players that have played in that field and in that city at some point in their time.
We'll leave it right there for tonight. We'll pick it up next week because we'll all be able to see the game tomorrow night. We'll be able to see the stadium, which has really been tremendously reconditioned. It's outstanding. You're going to have a number of the former Negro League players who are still alive. I think five or so are going to throw out the first ball. But, Mike, thank you very, very much. We'll pick it up next week. From there, we'll see how the game goes tomorrow night. We'll go right from there.
All right. Looking forward to it as
always.
Have
a great week, Mike. Take care.
You too.
Don, you know, I just want to say, sorry I couldn't get on earlier about Willie Mays. I've told the story right after the World Series, 1958, at Connie Mack Stadium, but there was a barnstorming tour of Mickey Mantle's All-Stars and Willie Mays' All-Stars. And I was there at Connie Mack Stadium, and a guy approached me if I would want to make $50 to drive Willie Mays' car to Syracuse, because that's where they were going to be the next night. And, you know, I'm thinking, I just got my license a few months before, and I could see my father if I came home and said, hey, listen, I got to take Willie Mays' car to Syracuse. he would have thought, what is wrong with this young man? But anyway, I love Willie Mays. I saw that catch, you know, replay. But you know what we used to do, and I know you did, especially living in Trenton, you got to see all those Giants games on WOR-TV. And what was it, Russ Hodges and Al Helfer, right?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, we got between the Dodgers and the Giants, we saw every game almost. I won't say every game, but most of the games. But let's get back down to the Baltimore area. And Doug Hamilton, our PGA professional, but we'll talk about, because I do not have prime, so I don't know what the score is of the game tonight between the Orioles and the Yankees. What do we got? What do we got tonight, Doug, before we talk golf?
You've got the return of Gerrit Cole, who lasted four innings. It was 1-1 when he left, and then Ramon Urias just hit a two-run homer to make it 3-1, and that's last I saw. So
it's 3-1 now?
Yes.
Okay. And give me a little bit of the background on Judge being hit, because that was quite a story today and yesterday that they held him out today, but it was not a good feeling about him being hit.
Whoop-de-doo. I mean, the Yankee fans are the worst fans on the planet. They're so arrogant. They think that their proverbial stuff doesn't stink, and they're claiming that the Orioles are – you know, the kind of team that is pitching inside too much. Okay, so first of all, that's legal in baseball. You're allowed to knock people off the plate, okay? And second of all, the New York Yankees have hit 40 couple batters this year while the Oriole pitching staff has hit 24. So the Yankee fans and the media can go stick that up there, you know what?
Roger?
Listen, Doug is obviously not a Yankees fan, Don.
I hate everything about the Yankees. I hate their fans. I hate the stupid little sounds and music they play. I hate the fact that the first thing they say is we've won 27 world championships. They're arrogant, and they think that everything should be about them, and it's not.
And they don't like the Mets fans.
Well, that's clearly, yeah, I mean, that's right.
Well, tell us about this series, because this series has been a little unusual. The Yankees usually get out of Baltimore and struggle a little bit, but the last couple of nights, you know, they've played not great baseball, but winning baseball. And as I said, then this controversy came up about Judge, and as you say, tonight's a one-run game, so again, it must be a pretty good game. I can't see it.
Yeah, no, look, we can put air quotes around controversy, because I think this is just something that's being, you know, dreamed up by, you know, I mean, there was a segment by the two New York Yankee announcers last night after Judge got hit, and they were actually saying, as they were doing the broadcast, that somebody has to retort against the Orioles and hit one of their players because, you know, we're talking about Aaron Judge. He went to, you know, New York, whatever, Concentra or what, you know, whatever, you know, to get his hand x-rayed. And it's negative. I mean, there's nothing that happened. You're allowed, Aaron Judge basically stands on home plate. And if I'm a pitcher, I'm throwing inside against him because he needs to move off the plate, okay, because that's legal in baseball. So they need to stop this stuff because it's ridiculous. And there's no story there. There's no storyline. It's ridiculous.
Well, on a positive note, the Orioles looked good against the Phillies over the weekend.
Yeah.
The Phillies were lucky to pull that one out. And, listen, you're right, Doug. And, Don, remember what Bill Wardell said, get rid of the armor. Get rid of the armor on these baseball players.
Well, they really have it now, boy. They got it on elbows. They got it on their head, their neck, their legs. They're using a lot of armor now. Billy's right.
Getting hit by a pitch is one thing, but when you foul a ball off and it hits you in the shin or the foot, that daggone hurts. I mean, they put Kyle Tucker, who at the time was leading the major leagues in home runs, he's been on the injured list for some time now because he fouled a ball off his shin, and that daggone hurts. I'll tell you that right now. If you've ever done that, man, does that hurt.
Oh, it does.
Well, they say,
I've done it. Yeah, it hurts.
Well, let me before we come back to baseball, I want to get some of your comments on Roy last weekend because, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I mean, I've seen a lot of golf. I've seen a lot of baseball. I've seen a lot of sports in my life. But, boy, oh, boy, when you looked at him in that room all by himself, I mean, it really breaks your heart to watch him. Didn't even get a chance to go into the playoffs. He choked it all up himself. You can't blame anybody else. He did it to himself.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I mean, that's one of the beautiful differences of golf between other sports is I can't blame Don Henderson for throwing me a bad pass. I can't blame Roger Handler for not, you know, catching the baseball or, you know what I mean? That's, you know, he played and he missed the putts. And, you know, unfortunately, that's a huge stage. There's a lot happening there. I think we, as sports fans, look at that and say, okay, well, you know, he's Rory McIlroy. He should make that three-footer or whatever. But, man, your heart palpitates a little bit. You get, you know, a little nervy there, and things happen. I mean, it's the U.S. Open. It's a pursuit of, you know, a tournament that's a major for him that obviously he'd like to put that up on his mantelpiece. And, I mean, Rory McIlroy's won – what, 20, whatever, 25, 20, whatever, how many tournaments he's won. I mean, that's a pretty daggone good career, you know. So, I mean, he's not just, you know, he's not Tin Cup, you know what I mean? Like, he's not just some driving range pro that's just out there, you know, trying to get more lessons.
No question.
I mean,
no question about that. I mean, you're exactly right. He's been in the winner's circle a lot of times. And,
they were talking about the question, I forget, I was listening to 105.7 The Fan today, and they had a whole bunch of brand new different people on there because they were shifting people around, and one of the guys was a local guy that was talking about golf, and somebody had asked the question about Scottie Scheffler and where he kind of stands, you know, right now amongst you know, career wins, and where do we think he's projected to finish his career with how many and whatever. I think, what's he won, 10 or 11 tournaments? I mean, he's had an awful lot of success in a short amount of time. And if that's something that's consistent and sustainable throughout his career, where does he, you know, land? I mean, you've got the all-time greats. Clearly you've got Tiger Woods with, what, 82 wins. I think Phil Mickelson had 45, 6, whatever it was. I mean, that's – I mean, Vijay Singh had 34 wins in his – I mean, that's a daggone good career, you know what I mean? So to put – I mean, if you could sit here and tell me – that upon birth that I was going to win, you know, 26 tournaments on the PGA Tour. I mean, holy crap. Like, that's, yeah, I mean, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, can Scottie Scheffler sustain that? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, who's the next guy?
And plus the fact he wins 5 out of 6. I mean, that's even more remarkable. I mean, you know, who do you know that won 5 out of 6 tournaments?
Well, I mean, like, I'm guessing if we statistically had, you know, some version of computer or technology in front of us, I mean, I'm sure in the most dominant of dominant eras with Tiger Woods, he certainly won his share and was in the winner's circle, you know, quite frequently and had a chance to win every single tournament he played in, you know, for a while there. So,
no question. Roger?
Yeah, the talk about the LIV tournament, isn't there one coming up this weekend?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, unfortunately, you know, when I start thinking different golf tournaments, I mean, I'm and Frank had, when he patched me in, you know, we're talking about, you know, me being really, really, really extremely busy, almost to the point of being overwhelmed with summer camps now have started and all these
right.
different things. So I have a very small window, if that, to watch any golf at all, which I'm definitely looking forward to the British Open more so because, you know, that happens during the morning, which, you know, most of my days don't, from a teaching standpoint, don't typically start until about noon. So that would at least give me a chance to watch some
golf. Well, this is good because this is the Travelers this weekend, which is another designated tournament, which is the extra $20 million. And I was looking. I did not see whether Rory would decided to play this tournament or whether he had bypassed it after what happened last week. But all the top – it'll be just like the Open. All the top players from both circuits will be playing this week because it's one of the designated tournaments. And it's one of the shorter. It's only you know, it's a much shorter course but a much narrower course. And so it'll be interesting to see how they play. But it will be a big weekend.
Bryson DeChambeau, you know, is one of the very models from the premise of how me and one other guy in the academy teach. So a lot of the things that he does from his setup to, you know, all the way through his golf swing are a lot of the things that we teach. So I do root, I think, for Bryson in so much as the fact that, yes, he is that model for us, but also, you know, I hate to say it, but I mean, if it makes me who I am, I'll wear that hat. But I mean, the U.S. Open to me, I want an American to win. So regardless of whether he's on LIV Tour or PGA Tour, I don't really care, you know. So it is the U.S. Open, and it's open to anybody that wants to play in it, provided they qualify. So it's the fairest of fair.
Well, Tiger, after Friday's round, when he missed the cut, said that they are getting much closer to a unification. So we'll just have to wait and see how close Tiger is to his prognostication of the unification. Roger?
Sure.
Yeah, well, I'm anxious to see some of the play on this because what I've read, I was reading in the Post today, too, about it, that, you know, they're getting a lot of notoriety about this tournament. And I just hope that, you know, I get to see, well, I know I'm going to watch some of it, and I'm not the greatest. I like watching golf, but I'm a lousy golfer. And but I know my limitations. So but I'm interested in this.
Sure, but as a sports fan, I mean, I could tell you the same thing. Like, I love watching hockey, but holy crap, if you put me on skates, I mean, my deductible is so high for my insurance that I just couldn't do it. I mean, I would have to, it's like being on a skateboard. Holy moly. I mean, those guys on skates and just how big they are and the things that they do while they're twisting and turning and skating backwards. I mean, it's the same concept for me is, you know, I love watching it and appreciate, you know, but soccer's the same way. Like, to me, I am not a soccer fan. I could care less about soccer. If soccer was no longer a sport, it wouldn't change my life. I understand, you know, how important it is to certain people that love the game and in Europe and all the different leagues and how much those guys condition themselves and how, you know, good they really are as athletes. That I can appreciate, but to me, it's a worthless, you know, I would rather do anything else. I would rather mow my grass than watch a soccer game.
Roger?
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. Okay. Me too. However, you do what you need to do sometimes.
Sure.
So
absolutely.
That you can, like watching the UFL, Don. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
some of the games. Don never turned the game on. Am I correct?
Well, there's so many things, I'll be honest about it. There are so many things that are important that, you know, like we talked about this, the Open. Now, the Open is on the same time the soccer is on. The week before, I forget what the big games were the week before, but there were two big Yankees and somebody and maybe the Orioles and somebody. You know, I can't watch soccer when that's on. I mean, I can't do it. And
right.
The same thing with the UFL. I don't take, as I said to Trevor, I don't take anything away from the players. I wish them all luck in the world. I hope they're good enough to develop and go into the National Football League. But
yes.
To spend a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon watching the UFL, I can't do that when something of importance is on a post to it.
Well, I would liken that, Don, to saying I have, you know, let's just pretend we have a family of four and we want to go do something. We want the experience. Okay, let's go watch a minor league baseball game, right? Let's go watch the AA team. So I want to watch a baseball game. I want to see some of the prospects, but I don't want to pay an arm and a leg in town in Baltimore and sit at Camden and $12 beers and $4 waters and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Let's take my family to have a similar experience. And so to me, that's what, you know, the if you will, the step down versions of, okay, well, there's no Ravens football on right now, so I can't watch it. Do I really want to watch a football game? I don't know, maybe. But if I did, it would be, woo, the Defenders or whatever. Maybe that would be a cool experience. You know, we would do it once and we would say, okay, thumbs up, thumbs down, and let's move on to the next thing, right? Similar.
Right. Well, as I say, I'm just honest about it. There are certain things that take precedent over other things. And for me, when there's important games going on, that means something. I mean, I'm not saying that the UFL doesn't mean anything. It does. It means to that league and to that area, Birmingham and all those areas. It's very important there.
Absolutely.
But here, as I've said many, many times, the first story that I even saw in print in the Post was today when the young fellow from America Samoa, a center who went to Hawaii to college and spent from the time he was 18 till now 25 going in these different leagues, whether it was whichever league you want to talk about, he played, and now he's got an opportunity to go in with the Jets. And there was a major story in the Post today about him and his size, his weight, American Samoa, nobody else has ever had the opportunity to be in the National Football League. And, you know, I read all about it, and I want to see what he actually does. They say he's going to have a very tough time because the Jets spent a lot of money in the offseason improving their offensive line. And he's a center guard at 326 or 336, something like that. And I thought it was a very interesting story, but it's the first story I've seen on the UFL the whole season.
Well, let us not forget, I mean, the path that Kurt Warner took from, you know, the Arena Leagues. Let's not forget, you know, different players that maybe came from the Canadian Football League. Let's not forget. Oh. I mean, there's all these options. But
here, glad to get you with
like,
us. Take care, fellas. We'll get together again next week and kick it all around.
Okay.
Take
sounds
care.
Good. Have a great week. God bless. Take care, Doug.
Frank, take care of the clothes.
Yeah, Randy. Thank you, everybody, for being on. It's a great job, Doug. Great talk to you each week. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation.
The men and women of the United States Armed Forces, the men and women of Peace and Fire Services. When you're out there and see somebody in uniform, please let them know they're there. These programs are dedicated to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Sergeant Thomas Fager, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Chris LeVake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Sherman and Offa Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant R. Pope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Chief Al Hugo, Longbow Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Florida Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Jeffrey Zen, Florida Highway Patrol, Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Police Department, Temple University Police Department, and Sergeant Armando Mendez, Philadelphia Police Department, and the Philadelphia Airport Police. My brothers and sisters, you may be 10-7 at this point in time, and sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rain fall softly on your fields, and the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family in the hollow of his hand. God bless, and have a great week.
Shem alek ma yilama, shem ahezah yilma, son ashen evorat fed, hakuig again ma yilma.
County Dispatch in 1999. All units be advised, 1999's response was last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Good night, Bob. We love you. We miss you. And happy birthday.